Welcome back to the Church Planner Podcast. Peyton Jones, your host today, and I'm here with not only someone I deeply respect, but also a friend, a mentor, and unfortunately for him, one of my former bosses. He can talk about that if he wants. I'm here with Todd Wilson, co-founder and former CEO of Exponential, a national nonprofit. Well, wait a second, this is Church Planner Podcast. You know who that is. You know what Exponential is, so we're not going to tell you more about it. But he's also the founder of Multipliers, an initiative focused on activating the Latin multiplication capacity within the body of Christ. Todd, welcome.
Peyton, great to be here. Really been looking forward to talking to you.
Yeah, it's good. You know, you've authored a number of books. One of them that I still dip into regularly is called More. Tell us a little bit about that book.
Yep, it's... You know, you have those books because you're an author that just are kind of the passion heartbeat books. And More is a book about personal calling, my own journey from marketplace into ministry. And as we'll get into later, working with Bob Buford and other things, More just became the heartbeat book of the process of gaining clarity on calling, you know, how we're uniquely wired to be mobilized into you know, as missionary disciple makers, but our unique wiring. So More is really what I'd call a personal calling and mobilization book.
That's really good. And I know it's a personal passion. I have actually been in a group with you, a cohort, which is all about personal calling. And you've helped leaders like J.D. Greer and a lot of big names that we would know kind of help figure themselves out and the calling God has. But today we're going to talk about your latest book, one that has been years in the making. And it's called How Did We Get Here? Can't wait to talk about that. But before we get into that, I first want to ask you, since that's a book about recent church history, how did we get here today? I want to ask first, how did you get here? What's your history? Because a lot of people don't know behind the scenes. We've all heard of multiplication movement. We've all heard of Exponential. A lot of people don't know how that all came about. And you were kind of right at the center of that.
Yeah, I appreciate the question, Peyton. When I reflect, this book on how did we get here, looking back to look forward, really documents an overview of the last 75 years of the modern church growth movement. So personally, in the two-year process of writing this book, it in some ways became biographical for me. I'm a behind-the-scenes person. When you think about Where's Waldo, a Where's Waldo book of page by page looking for Where's Waldo, I didn't realize till writing this most recent book that even before I was a Christian, I'm on the pages of this book. Going back to the seeker movement, and my family was a seeker target, you know, before we were Christians. And so I spent my whole career up till mid-career in the marketplace, became a Christian at age 22, and experienced a lot of what we would say is the modern church growth movement, large churches, multi-site, you know, the different things. I, kicking and screaming, got a call into full-time vocational ministry in 2000. When that happened, an entrepreneurial switch went off, really just drawn to the church planting space. So, you know, for me in that 1998 to 2000 window, I'm going into full-time ministry, kicking and screaming, but the entrepreneurial switch just lands me squarely in church planting. The church that I went into full-time vocational ministry at, New Life Christian Church, strong church planting church. It's so strong you don't hear about them. They're just getting the work done behind the scenes. And our vision in 2000 was, how do we move from doing one church plant every couple of years, you know, to how do we get to where we're planting tens and 20s and 30s of churches a year? And so that was my entry in 2000 into ministry. I had no idea. Now looking back, it makes sense, but a significant transition was going on in that time period. You were seeing, I'm going to say, the decline of denominational church planting, and you saw the rise of modern church planting networks. And that was all emerging right in the 1998 to 2002 window. And so in some ways, just like Where's Waldo on the page, I find myself drawn to church planting, right at a time when the modern church planting networks are just ramping up. I ended up entrepreneurially involved over the course of a couple of years between 2000 and 2005, either starting ministries that help church planting or re-engineering ones that were trying to do it. And in the process of that, in 2002, New Life Christian Church, which is my home church, strong in church planting, we saw this emergence of the modern church planting networks. So we founded a nonprofit called the Church Planting Network. And our vision was to be like the Chamber of Commerce is in business, to advocate church planting, but to serve all of these emerging church planting networks that work, from Acts 29 to ARC to City to GlocalNet. You just look at all these ministries that are emerging right in that time period. And we wanted to start a network of networks that could maybe help pour gas on what those networks were doing. Very quickly, 2003-ish, having network in our name became problematic because each of the existing networks would say, well, we're already a network. Why do we need another network? And so 2004 to 2005, got involved in what was then called the National New Church Conference, which was a 35-year-old church planting conference. And I agreed to be the director of that for a year. And it just took off. Like, I mean, took off. And so what we did was we allowed the church planting network to event legally to eventually become what's now known as Xponential. So if you actually go look up the legal structure of Xponential, it's just a doing business as name. The parent ministry of Xponential is the Church Planting Network. And that came about really through this work in the early 2000s that led into it.
Well, it's amazing, right? Because I having had a seat in a back room at Xponential, I got a front row seat often to how the multiplication world would change. And I would know that a lot of the names that we know, like Ralph Moore, we know because you wanted us to know. You found Ralph Moore, and then you're like, hey, everybody has to know about him. Brian Sanders, before anyone knew, you're like, hey, could you be Brian Sanders' handler at Xponential? And he and I got to know each other in a car. His book hadn't come out. Nobody knew who he was. But I remember back then realizing God has used you really as kind of like a kingmaker. If you wanted people to know somebody, they got known. And you yourself, however, were kind of a, you weren't the guy to go stand on stage. You were behind the scenes. And that's one thing I've always respected about you is God gave you this incredible talent. I mean, you didn't tell the audience that you were a nuclear engineer working on these massive projects for the military, probably saving the world. But when God moves you into ministry, you end up bringing a lot of that. And there's a key part of this story because I know you, one of your heroes and mentors was Bob Buford, who this next generation doesn't know. In the same way that I think, they maybe don't know how much you did. They probably don't know how much he did behind the scenes. And I know your book goes into that a bit, but can you just tell our audience who doesn't know, who was Bob Buford? How did God use him to spark these movements as well?
Right. Well, let me just start with that early 2000s, then I'll go back and show the significance earlier. So, when Dave Ferguson and I were co-founding Xponential in the 2005 to 6 window, we both had been mentored by, involved with Bob Buford and Leadership Network and influenced by that. By then, Leadership Network was a little over 20 years old, well established. We'll talk about that in a second. They were one of the only ministries that I know of that their mantra was, our fruit grows in other people's trees. They weren't in competition with anybody they were serving. They were just trying to pour gas and fuel leadership and innovation in the church. So things like the multi-site phenomena and the externally focused church phenomena and those sorts of things, many of those phenomena in the church were, it was Leadership Network that really was highlighting them and pouring gas on it and had a publishing line to go around them. And so in that early 2000s, having been personally influenced by Bob Buford, both Dave and I, we decided in getting Xponential going that we would take the same posture, that Xponential would, just like Leadership Network, we would almost be like a sibling ministry. Let's function just like it. Our fruit grows on other people's trees. We aren't going to compete with anyone in the church planting space. We're going to try to pour gas on everyone in the church planting space. I've used before the analogy to the Chamber of Commerce. The Chamber of Commerce in business does not compete with business. It's the number one advocate for business, pouring gas on what it does. We simply wanted to be the Chamber of Commerce in the church planting world, pouring gas on. So for me personally, if I now look back on Bob Buford, Bob was a very successful marketplace leader. Very successful cable company. He made a lot of money at it. Bob was mentored by Peter Drucker, the father of modern management, for over 20 years. They were very close. And Bob just decided in the process of making the money on the company and eventually selling the company, what does it look like to fully invest myself and my money in the kingdom and really seeing the kingdom advance? And Bob's position in that, or posture, really was this: I want to be the catapult, not the plane or the carrier. I want to be, I want my fruit to grow on other people's trees. Just this posture of how can I help you? And so in 1984, Bob had looked at a bunch of different ways of getting involved. In 1984, what you've got going on is the seeker-sensitive movement's at its peak. Hybels is gotten things going and put a name to that. Robert Schuller has really had a hand in all that. You've started to see Rick Warren come on the scene. So what does Bob Buford and Peter Drucker do? They say the next generation of church leaders are going to be these young guys like Bill Hybels and Rick Warren. We need to come alongside them and just pour gas on what they're doing. So in the early 80s, Peter and Bob convened the first ever large church gathering of these probably 20 plus pastors, guys like Randy Pope and Robert Lewis and Bill Hybels. They're all young kids at the time who are going to be growing big churches. And Bob just said, I want a front row seat to it. I want to help bring management and leadership to these young guys and watch the fruit that comes out the other end. Now, in the process of doing that, it just really gave Leadership Network from the early 80s all the way into the 2000s pioneers in all these different church growth, kinds of innovation things out there. And then I had the blessing of being a personal strategic advisor with Bob for about 15 years.
Yeah. And I mean, it's amazing, right? Because I mean, in your book, you talk about like the Burning Bush Conference. I did not know about that. That was before my time. I was over in Europe. I didn't get here back to the States till 2010, 2011. But when I got here, I remember going to Xponential and feeling like this is the Lollapalooza of church, multiplication church planters. And I walked around going, this is my people. These are my people. Like, this is where I belong. And it was crazy. I guess it'd be like if you were like a stamp collector and you go to a stamp collecting convention and everyone else thinks you're weird, nerdy, or whatever, but you go there and you're like, okay, you get me. You understand. Like, we are the same. This is cool. And but I didn't know that even back, the Burning Bush Conference, that you had Bob Buford pouring gas on the fire of things like Xponential, right? Acts 29, all these things that we know today that got started because there was someone behind the scenes like pouring gas on it.
I think, Peyton, what you're highlighting is, I mean, some of us were in the middle of a bunch of this, but not realizing till later how all the dots fit together. So, like, if I take what you're talking about right now, I was oblivious to the things we're talking about happening before 2000. So, early 1990s, Leadership Network, in the research I did, very few large leadership conferences before the early 90s in the church space. In fact, virtually all of the leadership conferences I could find or leadership gatherings were typically what you'd call spiritual leadership. It's the character of the person. Probably a lot of stuff we need to get back to now was what you had before the 90s. Robert Schuller was probably doing by far in terms of volume of conferencing. He had an annual conference that, was possibility thinking kinds of leadership. And that's really what Heibels used to go to and was inspired there. But the early 90s, Leadership Network started what they called the Church of the 21st Century conferences. They limited it to a certain number of seats. I don't remember if it was 400 or 500 people, and it was an invite only. Get 400 or 500 people at this conference, and guess who? What church hosted and ran the worship and the programming? Willow Creek. So Heibels was
Interesting.
involved from the beginning in this Church of the 21st Century. Fred Smith Jr., who co-founded Leadership Network with Bob, when I interviewed him, he explained, because I was asking, well, what happened to this Church of the 21st Century? And he said, oh, in 1995, Bob and me and Rick and Bill Heibels, we sat at dinner, we popped the cork on a bottle of champagne, and we looked at Heibels, and that was the commissioning basically of the Willow Creek Leadership Summit. We handed off, stopped doing the Church of the 21st Century. And Heibels then fully kicked into gear on the Willow Creek Leadership Summit. If you look in that time period, Peyton, Catalyst ends up being born. Maxwell's doing all of his leadership things. That 1995 to 2000 window, I call it almost the invention and scaling of modern church leadership. You just didn't have it before then. And all of a sudden, you got the Leadership Summit in 95, 96. You've got Catalyst in 99. You've got Maxwell's things going on. So now enter Exponential in early 2000. I had none of that context coming into Exponential. And all we had, and this is where it's really fun, I hadn't yet met Bob. And the very beginning inkling of what we wanted to do with Exponential was, I remember telling a group of guys before I even agreed to do it, look, I'm willing to do this for a year. If we can run it in a way that when people are walking to the parking lot after it's over, they're looking at each other saying, who ran that conference? In other words, it was our fruit is going to grow on your trees. We're not, this isn't a Southern Baptist thing. This isn't an Episcopal thing. This is a church planting thing. It's a cause-based thing. And I would say that's the strength of Exponential today. As Dave Ferguson says, it's a community with a cause. And that all started with this posture that we got from Bob Buford.
Well, that is perfect for leading into the book. This idea that all this other stuff that we didn't know about has created the world that we plant in today. It's created the church we know. It's created the barriers we come up against. It's created the good, the bad, and the ugly. Because we tend to have, what Martin Lloyd Jones and even C.S. Lewis talked about as a chronological superiority or snobbery. We look down our noses at the people that went before us, but we forget these were pioneers. These were people that created the world we know out of a world that was much worse. And that's what I appreciate about this book, to be honest, is it is an honest look at what happened. It's not looking back and painting everything, as all bad or black. It's not looking back with rose-colored glasses. It's looking back and saying, you just need to know this because you are a product of it more than you realize. And if we're going to get out of the bad and embrace the good, we need to understand what happened before. I have a question I'd like to kind of kick off from, and feel free to comment on anything I just said. Was that okay?
Oh yeah, it's great.
All
Love it.
right, all right. Well, you and I have talked about this book. I mean, I remember you and I going for a walk in Tennessee and talking. I remember you confessing, this is going to become three books really quickly. But and there is a funny origin story of how this came. It started as one chapter of a whole nother book.
That's
But
right.
was there a particular moment in all this ministry, all your past, all the background, everything that you went through, where you realized, coming into Xponential, coming into the multiplication movement, really spearheading that for us, where you realize that the problems we're facing now weren't isolated issues, but symptoms of a much deeper story.
Yeah, I can give you the season and what was happening when that aha happened for me. I think who doesn't want up and to the right, the hockey stick of like an exponential impact curve. Early on at Exponential, the language we adopted from the very beginning was movement, movement, movement. We want to be part of movements. I would say for me personally, I backed my way. Okay, a movement's an outcome. Okay, multiplication. Okay, church planting is what we're, somehow there's got to be this alignment. And I'll confess for me, the alignment is at the middle of my thing is church planting. And somehow church planting needs to produce church multiplication, which gives us movements. I'll tell you early on, I remember thinking, what I there's a thousand things I can go do with my life right now. Why do I want to do this exponential thing if we're not going to be a part of seeing multiplication and movements happen? And that's what I'm going to tell you for the 18 years I was there, that's what drove me, Peyton, was the idea. We need this, hell is real. Lost people are going there. There's an urgency. We need to see multiplication and movements happening. And I remember it happened over the course of about 3 years that we embraced a mission that we call the 16% mission. Sociologists will tell you that if you can get 16% of a population behaving a certain way, it becomes normative. Well, what we found was in the very beginning, the first time we measured it, the best of our ability, we thought maybe 4% of US churches were reproducing. 96% are not reproducing. Well, how are you ever going to get multiplication and movements if only 4% of churches are reproducing? So we latched on to what we called the 16% mission. It drove everything, all the decisions. What events would we do? What resources would we put out? And again, for me personally, I'm very much on that capacity building side of scale. Like, how do we get more church plants? Which leads to how do we get more planters? And it was around 2015, 14 or 15, we did an annual theme on disciple making. And what we looked at was five shifts that the church needed to make to see disciple making become more normative. This was the first time that my paradigm really started getting challenged. There's the 16% mission. I think we need more church planting to get there. And in doing that annual focus on disciple making and what the shifts needed to be to get there, it became abundantly clear we don't have a church planting problem, we have a disciple making problem. And so out of that, we've co-founded discipleship.org to go do in the disciple making space the same thing we were doing in the church planting space. And over the next couple of years, I'm feeling like, okay, we're on to something with the disciple making piece. And then I realized, okay, disciple making is how we add. We want to see movements, which is how we scale. Like, how do we extend? And that's where this idea of mobilization, wait a minute, we are so focused. The US church is the greatest volunteer mobilizer in the history of the world. But how are we doing it mobilizing everyday disciple making missionaries? So that now became, okay, it's not just disciple making. It's how do we mobilize everyday disciple-making missionaries? And I can't give you the exact date, Peyton, but there's an evolution driven by the 16% mission and recognizing, wait a minute, We've got a disciple making problem. Oh, wait a minute. We've got a saturation problem that we're never going to see gospel saturation without seeing mobilization of everyday missionaries. And somewhere as we came up upon COVID, I don't know if it was 2018, 2019, we did an annual theme on more, made for more, which was the mobilization part. And I distinctively remember this was the answer to your question. I remember the moment that I concluded we aren't going to accomplish the 16% mission with the operating system we have in the U.S. church right now. The operating system hinders reproduction, and you got to have reproduction to get the multiplication and multiplication to seed movements. So somewhere in that, right around the time COVID is hitting, I'm sort of having this crisis of, oh my goodness, I'm giving my life to a mission that I don't think the operating system of the church is going to let this mission happen.
Okay, so that's key right there, because it took a huge amount of honesty to look at Exponential and say, all right, we're not going to make it. Most leaders won't, they don't have the guts to look at that and to actually be honest and say, hey, we're not going to make it. I think that's the importance of the goal. Often what people do is, hey, well, maybe we'll aim for 8 or 9, you know? Well, we start at 4, that's double, that's good. But you actually were committed to that goal. So hitting up against, and I mean, you and I have talked about the operating system. And I hope I'm not betraying a confidence here. If I am, we can edit it out. But you started writing that book. And I remember you saying, this is the book that will change everything. But there was a chapter on history. And once it grew, I mean, I remember having a front row seat to that. And you saying, Peyton, you will not believe what I'm learning. I'm talking like you were like Stephen Ambrose, one of my favorite writers. He didn't just grab a bunch of books and talk about what happened on D-Day. He went and talked to all the guys that were there. That's exactly what you did with this book. You went and talked to the leaders like Robert Lewis, to the people like Bill Hybels, to the people that were there at the front row seat. And of course, you knew Bob Buford. So you have this really unique position where you were there in the church growth movement talking to the guy that was behind the scenes. Then you spearheaded the church multiplication movement. And now you've got a unique vantage point for the mobilization movement. So just keeping that in mind, I think it gives you as an author a unique authority. You were the person born to write this book. But obviously, that operating system is, if that's the barrier you came up against, then I want to ask, what is the operating system that is working inside that you think most pastors are too afraid to question?
Yeah, I appreciate it, Peyton. And I do want to clarify that in coming to that conclusion while still at Exponential, I think Exponential's got a very important role on the inspiration and this conversation and everything. It wasn't that Exponential in any way was part of the problem.
No,
It
no.
was, gee, in championing church planting and multiplication, if you just keep doing more of the same with inheriting and reproducing the same operating system, at some point you've got to change that. There was, as you know, in the 2000, especially with COVID and coming out of COVID, there were a lot of natural conversations happening on the operating system of the church. And it was really 2015 to 2020. You mentioned Brian Sanders. Lots of traction and lots of energy starting to go to microchurch and other expressions of church. And those were starting to get more conversation. Then you have COVID hit. And right around that time, as these conversations about operating system are happening, there was groups starting to look at the operating, like, what's this mean? What do we need to be doing different? And I think there were quite a few people who were looking at that. And so it was right around 2022 that I just decided, all right, I'm going to put my engineer hat on. I'm going to look at this through an engineering lens. There's operating systems and there's models. Pastors see the world through models. How do we tweak the model? What's the model to get there? And a model is something we see. It's like the app on the phone. The operating system is inside the phone or the computer, and it's ones and zeros that you don't see. But the operating system is really the wizard behind the screen that controls and shapes the model. And subtly, what I wanted to go do was take a look at, okay, there's all these models, but what's the operating system that sits under the model? And I'm giving you this detail, Peyton, when you say, well, what is it pastors are missing? The very first thing is we don't think about operating systems. We don't realize, I hate to tell you, there is a consumer-driven operating system that fuels the majority of the models in the US church. You might have 15 different models you could look at, but there's one wizard behind the screen that operating system is controlling it. So your question, well, what is it that people are missing? As I started digging into it and just looking at it, I wanted to like dissect the frog, open it up and look at the systems and understand this, what I ended up naming the consumer-driven operating system, and came up with about 12 different elements. I call them dilemmas that give us this consumer-driven system. And, not all of those 12 elements are equal, but they are like a flywheel. They build on each other. And so there's a combination of things. There's the dilemma of inheritance. I'm getting ready to start a church. Well, what drives how I started? Is it a season of prayer and fasting and discernment? Or is it my sponsoring church and organizations giving me the model I'm going to do? What's my definition of success? Is it building a large church that's sustainable? Is it gospel saturation? Those are two different end games. What's my growth engine? Is my growth engine a customer orientation driven by like the seeker sensitive movement that, how do we reach people and serve them? And our growth engine is a programmatic, institutional, Sunday-centric thing with a customer? Or is it a Jesus-style relational disciple-making engine that's disciples who make disciples who make disciples that plant churches that plant churches that plant churches? And at each one of these factors, Peyton, as I started peeling the thing back, they are so deeply embedded into a flywheel that they're so deeply embedded into this flywheel that we can call the consumer-driven operating system, that it's what makes it hard for pastors. We want the silver bullet. What's the pill I need to take? What's the thing I need to change? And right now, this consumer-driven operating system, it's so intricate and it's so complex that it's hard to put your finger on one thing. Now, if you made me put my finger on one thing, at the core, we have shifted from a relational disciple-making mission and engine to a programmatic institutional growth engine. We've shifted, and programs never reproduce, they only consume. Disciples can reproduce, but programs never do. So we've embraced a growth engine with a definition of success, that our definition of success, which is growing something large, can completely be satisfied through a programmatic growth engine without ever needing to make a disciple. And so that's what I'd put at the core.
Well, that's very near and dear to my heart. Obviously, that's where my life has shifted as well, and the same conclusion I came to, just maybe not as not through the same pathway. Because when you're looking at the story of how did we get here, where do you think, it's kind of like Bugs Bunny, right? He would always travel. You'd see that little dirt. That little dirt line moving, and he'd pop up somewhere and say, "This isn't Pismo Beach. Must have taken the wrong train to Albuquerque," right? That was always his thing he'd say. What was the wrong turn at Albuquerque? Where did the church go wrong?
Yeah, I feel convicted, Peyton. It's definitely an evolutionary. It's not an overnight they made one wrong turn. I think you've got a long history of well-intentioned apostolic evangelistic leaders, pioneering leaders, who are driven by reaching lost people, And we're the what I call the co-opting, Donald McGavran, who gets the credit of being the father of the modern church growth movement, who initiated it probably in around 1955. Here's what you got to get your head around. Donald McGavran, the father of the modern church growth movement, planted 15 churches, none of which ever were larger than 1,000. So the father of the modern church growth movement never planted a mega church or had a church that became a mega church. And yet the definition of success that eventually evolved was large and sustainable. So that's the co-opting, the scorecard changing from reproducing to growing large. That's what creates the havoc. Now, when you start grow the fruit of growing large, it's not bad to get large, but when you get large, now there's a sideways energy dynamic that leads you into, oh, we need a church CEO. Oh, with a church CEO, we need a church. You know, I'm sorry, we need a church CEO. Now we need a church COO. There's this entire leadership dynamic that if you're going to have a large church that's like an enterprise, and we shift from a mission-based organization to an enterprise-based organization, all of the consequences of trying to operate an enterprise give us much of the headache we have today. So where do you put your finger? Is it on the scorecard changing? Is it on the growth engine changing? And the combination of the scorecard changing and the growth engine changing, I think, even though well-intentioned, give us the consequence of a consumer-driven system. If I were putting a picture on it, and a lot of your listeners might not have even looked at Rick Warren's baseball diamond before, but you know, it was a very strong baseball diamond. Let's get them, you know, around the bases to home plate where they're fully engaged, and you know, first bases, let's get them converted and in our membership. And I think the co-opting that Rick Warren did not intend, but I think happened, was winning went from getting people holistically through the sanctification process all the way around the bases. Winning became the organization with the most people at first base wins. And we redefined winning as the conversion process of getting as many people to first base. And guess what? You don't need a holistic relational disciple-making path as an engine to get people to first base. You just need great Sunday service, great marketing, great outreach. And I think that's what happened. We let the large church phenomena scorecard shape the strategy and the outcome of what we're doing.
Well, you spend a lot of time around church planters and multiplication leaders in the book. Todd, do you feel, because part of my joy in seeing this book was that passage. It says John the Baptist, right? He's meant to turn the hearts of the fathers to the hearts of the children. There's this generational gap, right? We're talking all about next gen, and of course, the Spirit's moving there. But then we have this whole generations of people that went before us with the same desire, this same, like you said, to reach the lost. But I want to ask you, do you see right now younger leaders asking different questions in previous generation or the same?
I probably have a little bit, you know, I mean, we only have our view that we have. So this isn't research with a broad view. I mean, all I have is my own perspective. And I had to make a decision, Peyton. You know, the title of the book was Looking Back to Look Forward. I'm a futurist that spent 2 years writing a history book. By the time I was finishing this, I was ready to get back to the future. My original intent was half the book to be looking back and half the book to be looking forward. And Robert Lewis, who did the foreword on the book, Robert's one of the pioneers of the large church phenomena. He's a personal mentor for me. Robert told me partway through the book, he said, "Todd, your role is not to predict the future at this point. Your role is to help people understand the past and the context of how we got where we are." And here were his profound words. He's a boomer, I'm a boomer. He said, "Boomers like to build, boomers like to scale, Boomers like to tell the rest of everybody how to do it. And he said, the biggest challenge that we're going to have in the future is boomers built what we have right now. The handoff has now happened that Gen X leaders are the gatekeepers of the church. Many of them wanted to see different expressions with missional and other things, but the depth of captivity in this consumer-driven system, for the most part, it's Gen Xers who now hold the keys. They're the kingmakers over the consumer-driven system. They inherited it. So now you've got millennials partly starting to be in that same inheritance, but you get to Gen Z, Gen Alpha, and the question does become, do they really want to inherit this thing? Do they really want this consumer-driven system? Or do they want to flip it the other way to what you've called kind of the disciple-making missionary approach? Like, how do we get out into the cracks and crevices of society with a different scorecard of gospel saturation and impact instead of a large church phenomena? So what I would say is I'm optimistic that I think the next generation, out of all the chaos that we're coming out of and the disruptions of the last decade, I think we have a generation ready for something different. Now, what Robert Lewis said, Peyton, to me, and it's what shaped the way I ended up doing the book, I only gave one chapter at the end of the book to the looking forward. And the reason for that is, and it's Robert's words, what we should not do as boomers and Gen Xers is give the next generation the playbook. What we need to do is give the next generation permission and encouragement to create a new playbook and new playbooks. And I think that's the challenge we've got. Right now, my experience in the conversations I'm in, probably the number one emotion that this book is tapping into is with boomers and some Gen Xers, that it's naming the angst they have about the current operating system. It's Houston, we have a problem. There's a lot of lead pastors that are sitting in successful churches and successful chairs, and they know there's a problem. They know there's something wrong with this system. And I think they've got to allow that naming of the angst to not translate into fixing the problem. They've got to let it play into giving permission and encouragement to the next generation. Now, Gen X, we just have to call it what it is. It's the Gen X leaders. It's the Joby Martins and the J.D. Greers and the Matt Chandlers. And you can go down the list of the millennial or the Gen X leaders who are the current gatekeepers of the church. Question is, are they going to find the Bob Buford posture of you can do it, how can I help you? And give the permission that there's new playbooks in the future and we're not just reproducing and inheriting a flawed consumer-driven system.
I love that because I think what's happened with this next generation that's coming up now is they didn't wait for us to give them permission. They didn't wait for us to hand them pulpits. They just had the internet and they, you know, you it's a phenomenon. There are churches here in SoCal where the pastor might have a few thousand people on a Sunday, but an influencer in their congregation can have hundreds of millions that they preach to regularly. These influencers are touching audiences that Billy Graham would be jealous of. And it's amazing because they blazed their own trail. And so it's not even that they, I love what you said about not giving them the playbook because they're not even playing on the field that we played on. They're on a complete, like they're not in our stadiums now. Like, and they will go to church. These people, they're still going to church, but they're going to church for something different. You know, they're not going seeing the church as the answer anymore. They've created their own answers. And that may open up a whole new can of worms, but when you look around right now, what do you see that God's doing that's giving you hope?
Yeah, I think Peyton, over the last decade, I think this shift from a church planting emphasis to a disciple making emphasis is the right conversation. I think now what I'd call the macro shift from not just disciple making as what you do and how you add, but mobilization as the how you extend the impact of that. And extend meaning we're seeing, I'll say it this way. When I came into ministry in 2000 and right into church planting in that first few years, I'm going to go out on a limb and say, I never had a conversation about gospel saturation. It wasn't part of the vocabulary. The issue was is starting and growing a church. The vision of a bigger, wait a minute, what's it mean to own your geography, to see every man, woman, and child in your geography have something, and the collaboration that has to happen in that, and the disciple making piece with mobilization that has to happen in that. I think the next generation right now instinctively wants that. I think they are wired for that. And so I think this evolution from sort of programmatic to a disciple making to a mobilization, the timing of that coinciding with the next generation and what their desires are, that's very encouraging for me.
That's
Like I,
super cool.
yeah.
Yeah, and I love that because it echoes this book to me. How do we get here? Looking back to look forward. It's to me, it's an echo of what Jesus said when he said, you say, hey, the sky is red. He says, you don't even know the times. That's what he said to the religious leaders. And to me, it feels like this book is kind of an attempt to say, hey, you need to understand the times. You need to know where you're at right now. Even Martin Lloyd Jones, he turned, I mean, it's arguable that he turned evangelical Britain around in a different time with different problems. But there's a book out there called Understanding the Times, where he did very much the same thing that you're doing here. And I'm just so grateful you did it. Can I ask you a kind of a out of left field question that I have a reason why I'm asking this and why I'm going this way? Knowing you and being in your coaching for life planning, and knowing your background as a nuclear engineer, you would tell us about stuff like FIPTA and your approach to things. And I really think that as we close out, I would love for people to hear how your mind works. Because when I worked for you, it wasn't long. I think we worked together for a year, and then I jumped ship over to Through the Word because just felt that's where God wanted me. But working with you for a year was fascinating. Like, I'm so grateful to God that I got to learn from you and watch your mind in action. Like, you guys have to understand what Todd said a few minutes ago about the shift from church planning to disciple making. And you might think, Peyton, you keep giving him credit for stuff. And yes, I do, because I was there and I watched it. I watched Todd saying these things. And then I heard the buzz out there, in the church planting world. I mean, I had the biggest church planting podcast out there. And, Todd would say these things. What would happen when Todd would approach these problems? They would change and they would shift. And the public consciousness within the church would rise. So, in one sense, it's giving honor where honor's due. But I love like I feel like I'm a studier of people. When I worked for you, I watched you, and I tried to learn from you because that's always when God puts me with someone. I think, oh, I want to learn, but I don't think I fully understood you until in the life planning you described as a nuclear engineer what you guys had to do. Like, you had this actual submarine out in the desert that was an exact replica of the ones out at sea, and you could take that thing apart piece by piece. And you guys, when anything to do with the nuclear reactor, if it went wrong, you guys had a process. You went through FIPTA. I mean, you don't have to go super big into it, but can you just kind of like tell how they trained you to think about things, because everything we're talking about here, there is a connection. That's what I feel like I finally understood you.
Wow, Peyton, I think first, you're giving way too much credit there. And then I feel like I want to turn it back around on you and say, well, Peyton, why don't you tell us how my brain works? I do think that we're all conditioned. I think, there's the natural wiring. For its good, bad, and its indifferent, I had about 15 years before going into ministry in arguably one of the top three engineering organizations in the world. Very disciplined. Admiral Rickover is the founder of the nuclear navy. And I mean, the average person just can't even comprehend how crazy the system, the discipline of it, the standard of it, the how it would work. If I had to boil it all down, though, I'll give you this paradox. I just said this to somebody yesterday, actually, and I've said this 100 times since I've been in ministry. There's an aspect that naval reactors for 15 years of being in that cult-like culture there, in many ways, we were more church-like than churches are. And we weren't a religious organization, but we were a family. We were 24/7. We really had each other's back. We could yell at each other in meetings, and then we had each other's backs. We never let the sun go down without resolving conflict. We took issues on head on. So the first thing I would tell you was there was just a culture in place that it's similar but different. The Acts 2 church, where the standard is high, the family dynamics there. And so I come out of that as I come into ministry. And so that would be the first thing. The second thing that I would say, if I'm trying to boil down again how I think, and this recent book has helped me with this. When I came into full-time ministry in 2000, I don't know that I had heard the word leadership used 3 times in my 15-year history at Naval Reactors. We didn't talk about leadership. It wasn't a thing. We talked about management. And if I'm linking this back to biblical, people don't realize leadership is a 21st century invention. I've said this before as part of researching the book, from 1900 to 1985, you can't get a degree in leadership, undergrad or advanced. They don't exist till the 1990s. If you took the total number of publications on leadership from 1900 to 1985, it's flatline. It's a couple a year kind of thing. You get to 1985, and from 1985 to 1995, as the large church phenomenon is happening, we see the total number. There are more leadership books published from 1985 to 1995 than from all of 1900 to 1985. In 10 years, there's more books. From 1995 to 2005, it does the same thing. It's a hockey stick going up and to the right on this leadership thing. And what I would say to you is, where much of the church world is fascinated with visionary leadership, it's actually the word management that's stewardship. Well done, good and faithful steward. We're not talking about a leader in that statement. That's a manager. That is
Interesting.
somebody who's faithful with little, who can be faithful with much. And I when you're asking what's the posture of my head, I'm not thinking through the lens of inspirational leadership or what's the inspire thing or how do you communicate it the right way. I'm under the hood. My team at Exponential, Terry Saliba used to, I'd have this saying and I didn't even realize it. Help me understand. I'd get into
Yeah,
meeting.
you would
I've said
say
it to
that.
you a bunch of times.
You
Peyton,
did.
help me understand. And usually what help me understands mean, that's a management question. It is, hey, let's dissect the factual truth of, what this is. I mean, you referred to FIPTA. FIPTA is an entire process. Facts, intuition, principles, distortions, action. And what we like to do with visionary leadership is, oh, the gut intuition, let's jump to the action. And we skip the facts, the intuition, the principles, the distortions we have in our thinking. And where I come from in the nuclear Navy, oh, no. We don't go make significant action decisions without starting with the truth of fact. What's our gut telling us? What principles are going to shape how we interpret those facts? Okay, check. What distortions do we have in our thinking that might cause a problem? So even this FIPTA thing is a very, logical, fact-based. There's no emotion in the middle of it. And that's, right, wrong, or indifferent. I after 15 years of growing up in that culture, brought that to ministry.
Well, and that's what I love because for you guys, when it, you've told stories. I mean, there's a lot on the line when a nuclear reactor melts down or something goes wrong in a submarine or, and they hardly ever do because of the
Let's just be
incredible.
clear, Peyton, so we're not missed. They never do. That's part
They
of the history of it. They
never do.
can, but we didn't have it happen. I just to be clear.
Okay, no, I appreciate that because the amount of discipline in the that FIPTA process and all of that, like there was no room for messing around. And what I love about that story, and the reason I kind of went there was years ago, God called Dr. D. Martin Lloyd-Jones, Harley Street physician, which is the top of his medical profession. He is the assistant to Lord Hoarder, who is the Queen's royal, at that time, the King's royal physician. God calls him out for no reason that anyone can earthly see to leave medicine as the shining star. He's on his ascent in the UK, and God leads him to Port Talbot, Wales, an industrial dockside town with no future and no hope. And God brings him there, and he turns a country around. He had no theological training. It was the way he was trained as a doctor to assess, diagnose, treat, and prescribe. That's it. And he approached everything that way. And I see a parallel with your ministry to the church where God, kind of like he took a Pharisee and made him into a missionary, the Apostle Paul. It wouldn't be anyone's first pick for a great missionary, someone who's going to go change a world. He took a Harley Street physician and made him a missional preacher in blue-collar industrial South Wales. And then he takes a nuclear engineer and puts him right between these two movements with still enough life in him to do something about the mobilization movement that we're now in. To me, I just think that's fascinating, and you're one of my mentors, one of my heroes. I just wanted to call it out because I really think part of the beauty of this book is I don't know that anyone else could have written this book because they weren't 15 years working side by side with Bob Buford. They did not build exponential. And have that. And now to see where you're going next, that'll be exciting to watch. But I honestly think that nuclear engineer brain, God trained you in a way to assess the church, to almost run a FIPTA on the church, that same process, and put it into a book so that we can understand and ask that question. How did we get here looking back to move forward? So I want to thank you for your time today. On the podcast, Todd, for coming on. Todd Wilson's been my guest. His book, How Did We Get Here? It's going to explain the last 50, 60 years of church history, a little bit beyond, and bring us into the present day. Todd, where can they pick up this book?
Yeah, Peyton, you can, the way we're doing it, church-growth.org. So church-growth.org. The PDF version's free. The audiobook's free. There's a summary document that's free. The wiki's free. So most everything's free at church-growth.org. For those that still want the good old-fashioned way to read the book, Amazon, just Google, How Did We Get Here, Todd Wilson, and it's right on Amazon.
Awesome. All right. And if they want to track with you at all, how did they get in touch with you?
Through multipliers.org, all the contact info is there and the different ways to get me are that's sort of home base is multipliers.org.
Okay. Well, again, guys, my guest has been Todd Wilson. We've been talking about his new book, How Did We Get Here? And we'll see you next time on the Church Planner Podcast.